Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:30 p.m. here on Wednesday, February 25th. We are meeting in the Belts Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building, located in beautiful and snowy downtown Juneau. I just want to remind folks who are here in the room if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members and are uploaded to BASIS, which is available at akleg.gov. Additionally, if you're looking for copies here in the room, they're available right there by the door. Members present today are Vice Chair President Stevens, Senator Keel, Senator Bjorkman, Senator Yunt, myself, Senator Lukey Gale Tobin. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Susan from the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting and Mary Gwen from Senate Records for documenting today's meeting. On the agenda today, we have three pieces of legislation we will be considering. We will have the first bill, the first hearing for Senate Bill 187 prohibiting certain food additives in public school meals. We will also have the first hearing for Senate Concurrent Resolution 11 establishing a legislative commission to review and make recommendations to the legislature relating the official state seal. And we will have the first hearing for Senate Bill 157 and its House Companion Bill 176 relating to the notice of new fees and fee increases for the University of Alaska. We will be taking public testimony on all bills today. With that being noted, I just want folks to know that you'll have about 10 to 15 minutes to present so we can ensure we have time for public testimony. If you would like to provide public comments, please call one of the following phone numbers. If you are calling from Anchorage, the phone number is 907-563-9085. If you are calling from Juneau, the phone number is 907-586-9085. If you are calling from any other location, please call this toll-free number, 1-844-586-9085. You can also testify from your local legislative information office or email your public testimony to senate.education@akleg.gov. That's senate.education@akleg.gov. Just a reminder to those who wish to testify and are calling in, I would ask that you do not speak to us on speakerphone, that you take yourself off hands-free, as sometimes the message can be garbled. Additionally, if you do have written comments, I encourage you to send them to our email address, senate.education@akleg.gov, because that would be helpful for the Senate records. All right, moving on to our first item on today's agenda, Senate Bill 187, sponsored by Senator Bill Wilikowski. Senator Wilikowski is joining us here today along with his legislative intern, Phoebe Pepper, who is also here to introduce the bill. Senator Wilikowski, you know the drill. If you could please identify yourself and begin your opening remarks when you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage. I appreciate the opportunity of the committee to hear this bill. This is a bill that would prohibit the use of food dyes, a certain number of food dyes, in public school nutrition or meal programs. This is something that a number of states have done. States politically varied as California to West Virginia. And this is something that the Federal Food and Drug Administration has been talking about doing for 35 years. And you may ask, why are we doing it? We're doing it because the Food and Drug Administration has been talking about doing this for 35 years and yet has not done it. And individual states are taking action, and they're recognizing the dangers with food dyes and recognizing that we should be protecting our kids. I'll give you a quick story about why this is an issue that's personally important to me. When my daughter was about 5 years old, she went trick-or-treating. She came back with a bag full of candy, and she had a starburst. And she immediately broke out in hives, and her face began to swell, had problems breathing, and thought surely that could not have been caused by the single starburst which she restrainedly had. And several weeks later, took her out to Cold Stone for ice cream. Had some ice cream, and again, had another allergic reaction. Looked up the ingredient list online, and sure enough, the ice cream that she had was loaded with food dyes. I never would have expected that. I never would have expected to see food dyes in a whole host of different foods that our kids are exposed to every day. things like toothpaste, things like kids' medicine. We're not seeking to ban those things. We're not seeking to place warning levels on those labels on those things. I hope part of the reason I'm doing this is because I want parents to understand that these things are out there, and they're, some kids have reactions to them. Other countries have taken action to put warning labels on food dyes. Other states have taken action to ban them. We've checked with 10 school districts across the state. I know there's concern that there may be costs involved in this. My intern will go over the list if you would like, Madam Chair. But we've checked with 10 school districts across the state, large and small. Not a single one of them expressed concerns with cost from doing this. Not a single one. They did express concern about the effective date. This bill was filed last year. Happy to work with the committee on the effective date. There is one letter of opposition that we're aware of. There may be more. It's an industry letter from a chemical organization based in Washington, D.C., which, if I may read, Madam Chair, says this legislation is a misguided approach that will not improve health but will increase strains on Iowa schools. That's the letter dated February 23rd, 2026, to you, Madam Chair. It's apparently copy and pasted from an opposition letter that they've sent to at least one other state, probably every single state that's filed this. They've filed similar letters of opposition. And we know that the chemical industry, that's their job, that's what they do. They oppose these things. Just like for decades they opposed banning asbestos, for decades they opposed banning PFAS, flame retardants, mercury, lead and gasoline, even cigarettes. We know this is what they do. That's how they make their money. And as people who are charged with protecting the health and welfare of our people of Alaska, I think we should reject that. And I think we should take this very, very minor step to say we're spending a lot of money on our education in Alaska. We want our kids to be healthy. We're providing food for them. Let's just get this one minor little thing, which we know impacts kids, some kids, not all of them, a small percentage. But you know what? If it impacts a couple kids in a classroom and you got 35 kids in a classroom, that's going to have a pretty detrimental impact on the whole classroom as a whole. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity for this bill. I've got Phoebe Pepper here to provide some more details. Thank you.
Thank you. And good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phoebe Pepper, legislative intern to Senator Rulikowski. I am here to provide an overview of Senate Bill 187. SB 187 would improve the academic outcomes and health of our children by prohibiting synthetic food dyes from nutrition programs in public schools. Synthetic food dyes are ultra-processed chemical additives that serve an entirely cosmetic purpose, which is to alter the color of the food they are added to in order to make it look more appealing. Six of the seven synthetic food dyes outlined in this proposed legislation are petroleum-based, with the seventh, blue number two, relying on sulfuric acid in its creation. Both petroleum and sulfuric acid are highly carcinogenic, but these chemicals are, of course, filtered and reduced to amounts that the FDA has previously considered safe for consumption. However, health scientists have increasingly raised concerns relating to the side effects of these additives, ranging from hyperactivity in children to cancer. Indeed, the FDA acknowledged the cancer-causing nature of these dyes back in 1990, banning the usage of red number 3 in makeup products. The FDA then pledged to proceed by revoking the authorization of Red 3 in food and drink, but that process was delayed by 35 years due to the food industry lobbying against their removal. This process towards revoking Red 3's authorization only just began last year. The remaining six dyes, however, remain approved for use and are being seen in 19% of products by the top 25 food producers in 2020. The effort to remove these dyes from the food supply has been focused on schools due to the neurobehavioral and allergenic effects of these dyes disproportionately affecting children. Those under the age of 18 are over twice as likely to be allergic to synthetic food dyes. Additionally, research from the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, along with the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which are both included in your bill packets today, concluded that synthetic food dyes disproportionately affect children with ADHD and autism neurobehaviorally, and that removal of these dyes would reduce the severity of their symptoms. This has led to school districts across the state largely removing these dyes from their supply, with all the schools we spoke to, including Sitka, Petersburg, Delta Greeley, and Nome, stating that the implementation of this legislation would not cause a burden to their respective districts. They noted that their suppliers, mainly USDA, are already providing substitutes that they are turning towards. When speaking to food service administrators across the state, they noted how they were surprised to see natural colorings already present in their food supply, ranging from beet and red radish extract to turmeric. And while I know I don't need to explain that vegetables are healthy, these alternatives provide nutritional value and do the opposite of their synthetic counterparts, actually reducing the cancer risk and boosting brain function. These school administrators are fantastic at what they do, but we can never know how federal regulations may change. In the same way the processed food industry stalled the FDA in banning Red 3 for 35 years, they are attempting the same playbook today. The difference between the letters of support and the one of opposition provided in the committee members' bill packets could not be any more stark. And I will only simply mention that the organization in opposition is funded by corporations like PepsiCo, who all benefit financially from the sale of these chemicals. We urge the committee to consider the fact that while the ultra-processed food industry opposes this bill from outside our state, it is rural and low-income Alaskan kids here at home who are the most affected by these dyes. 46% of students in 2024 were enrolled in free school meals, and we owe these valuable children the consideration to improve the safety and nutritional value of the food that they rely on to stay fed, especially when school administrators tell us that it will not be a complicated change and it is a harmful chemical that provides no flavor nor nutritional value. While school administrators are acting upon these harmful additives, artificial food colorings hide in unsuspecting foods, including pickles, fruit jams, and cereal. Through this legislation, we have an opportunity to not only protect our children from these harmful additives, but encourage food producers to create more wholesome, nutritious foods that benefit all Alaskans. I would like to thank the committee for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Phoebe. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the bill and the introduction. I guess the price tag question looms. The department has said that it doesn't face any costs at the state level. And as I understood your opening comments, I think you talked to a number of school districts who didn't have any concerns about an increased price from the red dyes. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some of the most mass-produced commodity foods are the cheapest, and I know a couple of the school districts in my district are having to bring down the cost of the food they provide to kids as the public education dollar pinches. There's actually less local food, fresher, healthier, going into some of the school meals in a couple of my communities, just on price. Do we have any sense of what the price delta is likely to be if a piece of legislation takes all seven of these out of the realm of possibility?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you for that question. It's very valuable in this conversation, looking at those costs of schools. The first thing that we're considering with this legislation is we do not want it to be a burden on our public schools. That is the fundamental value of our office. And that said, of the 10 school districts, which I would very happily name all of those for you guys, I did ask that exact question. Do you guys foresee any cost increases related to having to substitute these dyes to other substitutes in foods? And most of them responded no. The ones I actually had three schools, Petersburg, Sitka, and Juneau, actually go through their food supply, and they said the highest of those three was they found six products in their entire food supply that contained any of these dyes. And Sitka in particular actually went and looked on their online ordering database through USDA, where they pre-order every February, and said that there is no significant cost difference for those substitutes, and actually that it's in some cases there's actually a lower cost option for these foods. Where the concern lies in ultra-processed foods that are, like you said, are cheaper sometimes, is the ones that actually provide a difference in flavor. These food dyes do not, so they seem to be actually less of an impact on cost.
Thank you.
Ms. Phoebe, can you identify yourself for the record?
Yeah. For the record, Phoebe Pepper, legislative intern.
Thank you. Additional questions? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you share with us the nine other states that have passed similar legislation? Because depending on their size and importance, or I guess size really, that will have an impact on what processed products are being manufactured in. And if large states are involved, it would have a great impact on what they're producing. Can you share those with us?
Yeah, absolutely. And forgive me, I actually didn't print out the nine I have, but the largest ones are West Virginia, Texas, and then the most significant one in the news recently was California. California actually has a really huge multi-hundred-page study on why these are harmful, and I encourage the committee members to look through that. But, yeah, of the nine, those are the four largest.
And Ms. Phoebe, if you could identify yourself for the record, and if you could get the remaining states to us, and we can distribute that to members.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you'd agree, I assume you agree that if big states, Texas, California, can make those demands and take these dyes out, then products will be manufactured with those removed, right?
Sorry, through the chair, could you repeat the question?
No question, just a statement. That just to repeat myself, that if those large states, their demands will probably lead to products being developed that don't have these dyes in them.
Right, and through the chair, resultingly, for the record, Phoebe Pepper, legislative intern, through the chair, that's actually a really valuable point. And since USDA is a large nationwide producer and supplier of these foods, it has actually encouraged them, since larger states have been enacting it, for it to be in the options, which I think is actually one of the contributing factors why this doesn't have a significant cost difference.
Thank you. Additional questions? I do have one question on line 6 of page 1. I see part of a school nutrition or meal program, but I see no definition. So I'd like to know just a little bit more about what you envision. Is this for after-school programs, athletic programs? Is this for residential school nutrition programs? What about if there is a culinary arts program like at King Tech? Would this also impact what they are able to produce or serve? If you could just expound a part on what you mean by school nutrition or meal program.
And for the record, Phoebe Pepper, legislative intern. So this would only apply, and you're right, there is no definition in statute. We actually looked for one. This does not apply to anything other than nutrition programs, which our intention in this bill is just to be the breakfast and lunch line in schools. We would be very happy to work with the committee to expand and make sure this definition is not affecting those other things, but it's our intention of this legislation to currently only affect those two meals of the day.
Thank you. So just to understand, it wouldn't impact summer nutrition programs or anything that is being offered in the school facility but not necessarily being provided by the school.
For the record, Phoebe Pepper, that would be correct.
Excellent. Any additional questions before we move on to invited testifiers? Seeing none, thank you so much. We'll now move on to your invited testifiers. I see that you have two listed. We also have Heather Heineken, the Director of Finance and Support Services from the Department, who is here to mention the zero fiscal note, but also is available for questions if committee members are so inclined. With that, we'll move on to our first invited testifier. We have Kendall Cruz, who is a registered dietitian and member from the Mat-Su Borough School District. Kendall Cruz, are you online?
Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Kendall Cruz. I am a registered dietitian. I'm speaking only for myself. With a decade of experience specializing in pediatric nutrition.
We'll take a brief at ease.
So healthy habits that support children's growth and development and academic success. And today I'm here to support SB 187, which prohibits use of artificial and petroleum food dyes in public school meals and nutrition programs. As a registered dietitian, I've seen the impact of diet on children's health and behavior. School meals are a critical component of children's nutrition, providing more than half of their caloric intake during the day for many children. Unfortunately, ultra-processed foods served in schools contain synthetic colors like red number 340, yellow number 5, and the others listed in this bill. While these dyes are approved for use, they've been linked to adverse health effects, particularly in children, for decades now. The research has shown that the artificial food colors can exacerbate hyperactivity and neurobehavioral symptoms in some children, including those with ADHD and autism. The best report that I've read has been a comprehensive report by the California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. And it concluded the consumption of these dyes led to hyperactivity and behavioral issues with varying sensitivity among children, but quite a large population of children. This is not limited to children already diagnosed with ADHD. The studies indicate that the dyes may have behavioral effects on a much broader population than previously thought, contributing to classroom disruptions and poor focus. A meta-analysis found 8% of children with ADHD experienced significant symptom worsening due to these additives. And beyond behavioral concerns, artificial dyes have been associated with allergic reactions such as hives, asthma, and serious gastrointestinal issues in sensitive children. Some evidence also suggests there's links to longer-term risks, including DNA damage and cancer, although more research is needed. From a nutritional standpoint, these additives offer zero health benefits, which I think is really important. They're purely cosmetic. Banning them encourages schools to prioritize whole and minimally processed foods that provide the essential nutrients without chemicals. I think this is a critical point that often gets missed. Ultra-processed foods are not in the best interest of children. They do not fuel their bodies for the best learning that they could have. Yes, they are cheap comparatively, but thankfully, because the big states that were previously mentioned have moved away from this, food suppliers are also moving away, and they're providing alternatives at similar cost. In Alaska, where many children rely on school meals as their primary source of nutrition, passing this creates a safer and healthier learning environment. Natural alternatives have been available forever that are made from fruits, vegetables, and spices. And this bill aligns with the best evidence-based guidelines from organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics. They highlight concerns about artificial colors in children's diets. I personally can attest to having had many patients, lots of families come to me and do elimination diets that start with food dyes that include ultra-processed foods, and they see significant changes in the behavior of their children and the children's ability to learn and sit and pay attention. So I urge you to support SB 187. It protects children's health and well-being across the whole state, in a state where we know that there's a lot of reliance on ultra-processed foods. By removing these diets from school meals, we can foster better concentration, reduce behavioral challenges, and promote lifelong eating habits that are healthy for children. I thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to stand and answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cruz. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you again for providing your invited testimony. We'll now move on to the second testifier. We are joined by Tamar Ben-Yosef, the Executive Director of the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, who is also joining us online.
Through the Chair, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tamar Ben-Yosef, and I'm the Executive Director of the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, A2P2. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the organization and its board of directors, which is made up of pediatricians, child advocates, and public health professionals. A2P2 is an organization dedicated to increasing access to healthcare and community-based services for children and their families and to their overall health and well-being. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 187, which would prohibit certain artificial food dyes in public school meals. This bill aligns with the science-backed knowledge that children benefit from diets centered on whole, minimally processed foods. These dietary patterns support healthy brain development, stable energy, improved classroom behavior, and long-term physical health. Today's hearing is coming on the heels of a heavy day for Alaskan families who learned that several more schools are closing, school nurses will be less available to their children, class sizes will grow yet again, and valuable programs that spark a passion for learning in kids will no longer be offered. SB 187 will not fix the short and long-term damages done by our failure to support public education, but it is even more critical now that we view the proposed legislation in the context of the broader goal we share, which is to create the healthiest possible environment for children. When many protective factors supporting learning and healthy development are being stripped from our schools, ensuring children have access to healthy, nutrient-rich, and minimally processed foods is the least we can do. School meals play a uniquely important role in children's nutrition. For many Alaska children, school is not just where they receive education. It may be the most reliable and consistent place for them to receive a meal. Schools also play a role in teaching students about the basic standards for health and safety. For young children, the food served to them in school and the information they are taught in class may be no different in their minds. If school says it's okay and healthy for them to eat colorful fruity pebbles for school breakfast, then it must be fine. While more research is required, There have been well-documented links between synthetic food color additives with challenging behaviors in some children, allergic reactions, and increased hyperactivity and irritability. More importantly, these additives serve no nutritional purpose. They exist solely to enhance appearance, not health. Fresh and wholesome food should not need food coloring to appeal to a hungry child. Finally, with the larger class sizes and fewer health and behavioral health professionals in schools to support teachers and students, reducing ingredients that have the potential of exacerbating behavioral challenges in kids is a reasonable and thoughtful measure and a step in the right direction of supporting our students' well-being. Thank you for your time and your commitment to Alaska's children.
Thank you, Ms. Ben-Yosef. Is there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you again for joining us here at the Senate Education Committee. We do have Heather Heineken, the Director of Finance and Support Services from DEED. Ms. Heineken, anything you want to say about the fiscal note?
Thank you, Senate Education and Chair Tobin, for the opportunity to share the fiscal note. The fiscal note for child nutrition, there is no cost to the department because the food is purchased at the district level. So the district, the department does not have any costs associated with this statute.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Heineken. I see no questions from committee members. We'll now move on to public testimony. I now open public testimony for Senate Bill 187. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing no one here in the room and no one online, I will now close public testimony. Any wrap-up comments you'd like to make, Senator Wilkowski or Ms. Pepper? None. Excellent. Well, we will hold Senate Bill 187 to a future meeting. If you have any amendments that you'd like to be considered for the legislation, such as tightening the definition of what is a school nutrition program, please work with the bill sponsor and myself, and we will bring this bill back up before us at a later date. Now moving on to our next item on the agenda is the first bill hearing for Senate Concurrent Resolution 11, sponsored by President Stevens. He is joined by his legislative aide, Tim Lampkin, here to introduce the resolution. You both know what you're doing. If you could please identify yourselves for the record and begin your opening remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak, thank you for hearing this concurrent resolution. The you all know the seal. It's all over the place. We're all wearing it, as a matter of fact. It's an infamous seal, but the one we see today was adopted in 1959 when we became a state. And it continues to hold up the era from the late 1880s to early 1900s, when Alaska was really seen and thinking of ourselves from the perspective of colonial expansion, of Western colonial expansion. And what we can figure out so far in our historical records, I appreciate that Tim has done a lot of work on this, is that it was adopted administratively by the governor, and it represents a federal executive branch. There was no deliberation. Talking about the earlier, one of the earlier seals, no deliberation by any legislative body because we simply did not exist at that time, so we were not here to be a part of it. In the earliest renditions of our seal, you'll see some really interesting elements, and Tim will show those to you. Igloos, a kayak, a native man in a kayak, pretty dense forests, and a native fur seal hunter, and getting the food, getting the fur seals ready for processing. But those original icons of Alaskan people's way of life were replaced in some of the later renditions by a mining smelter, and hills with no trees on them. So the trees were gone, and the mining smelter was there. An engine, a locomotive engine, timber, cargo ships, horse-drawn wheat harvester. And so the idea of considering a redesign of Alaska's official state seal, I think, is important at this time. We want to include a wide variety of stakeholders, artistic and design professionals, and make it a transparent process for finding consensus on a redesign that would better reflect the broad cultural heritage of Alaska's people. So maybe it's time to have a more comprehensive seal. SCR 11 does that, proposes to cast a wide net, a more modernized emblem representing Alaska's values and Alaska's the first people. Tim Lamkin has done a really fascinating job, and I think you'll find it interesting to see historically what our seals have looked like in the past. He spent a little time in the library, in the museum, and I'm really pleased with the information he's found, so I'd like to turn it over to Tim at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Tim Lamkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I thought it might be of note for you that this is not a new idea. This is a piece of legislation Senator Stevens introduced in 2021, sort of late in session, and at that time, under the constraints of the session and time frame that we had at that time, we had to set it aside. But since then, before session began, Senator Stevens expressed interest in rekindling this project, and that's why you have this before you now. It's also worth noting that this is not a new concept among other states as well. It's interesting that over time, according to the issue at hand and the interest level, sometimes we want to look and care about what other states have done in a particular issue. Other times we don't care at all. But just for the record, I would mention that at least the perusal that I've done initially, that Minnesota is the most recent state that has changed or modernized their seal in 2024. And as we speak, Massachusetts is presently also considering doing the same. I have a few slides for you to share. I guess I'd start with, of course, in 1867, as anyone here that took our Alaska history course in secondary school, Alaska was purchased from Russia in 1867. And I would note that the first 17 years from 1867 to 1884 was a lot of turnover. The first 10 years was run by the Army, and this is the a depiction of their seal at the time. Since the United States was founded, the Army had this insignia representing the Army, and that didn't change until, if I understand correctly, 1947. But it did change. Every one of these officers has a story behind them, and I didn't have time to go into deeply without getting sort of on a tangent as to what the scope of this project is. But I thought it's worth noting that, for example, the first one there, our first Army commander of the Department of Alaska at that time, was Jefferson C. Davis, and he had quite a story behind him, to include, just for starters, that he was present at the exchange between Russia to Alaska. He was in the room with Seward and others. All of these officers had extensive involvement in the Civil War. They, coincidentally, I noticed that virtually all of them had their focus of their military experience was in artillery. The average tenure of these gentlemen was 390 days, so just over a year each. And as with maybe even today, with folks that come to Alaska, you either love it and stay for the rest of your life, or you hate it and try to get out as quickly as you can. So that's certainly the case with these gentlemen. You may recognize some of these names, at least John Mendenhall, for starters, and a local glacier named after him. The second time frame, the second period, 1877 to 79, is a brief two-year period where, and I have not explored the question as to why they transitioned from the Army to the U.S. Treasury Department, Customs in particular, but that was likely, I would speculate, driven by the fact that there was quite an emerging or developing market. The economy was really growing quickly, and they needed someone to help collect the revenues or the potentially lost revenues that the federal government was realizing. These guys by the way, I'd mentioned that the seal there, the Treasury seal, was interesting note on the seal itself, existed before even the federal government was established in the Revolutionary War to help fund that movement. But these gentlemen, they averaged their span there for about 8 months at that time. If there was any official documents related to activity in Alaska, it was the use of that Treasury seal. Mr. Barry remained in Sitka the rest of his life. Mr. Motram Ball, incidentally, was the only Confederate soldier that I noticed. They all had military backgrounds. Mr. D'Anno was German-born, and he's got a storied past that I won't go into, but happy to tell some stories off record about that gentleman. As we move into the final era before we entered what was referred to as civilized government, they transitioned then back to the Navy. We had these gentlemen that were all, I would speculate, spent most of their time on the ships exploring Alaskan waters. Their average tenure was 8 months. Birdsley, for example, named Glacier Bay. Glass was known for his involvement in capture of Guam. And meanwhile, some of his memoirs reference struggling to preserve peace and property in Sitka in southeast Alaska. Merriman was involved in the infamous and tragic Angoon bombardment that you may have heard about. And then, interestingly enough, Nichols was the one that was part of the scientific mission that discovered the black-eyed goby, a small fish found in Alaska water. So those stories help indicate to me that those gentlemen may or may not have been more directly involved in the management or executive functions of the Department of Alaska at that time and were more interested in their activities at sea. And so transitioning from there, we come into the area or the era of 1884. A transition would mention that a lot of activity was engaging with the Department of the Interior, the U.S. Attorney General. It was the Organic Act of 1884 that established the quote-unquote civilized government in Alaska. We became from a department to the district. Governors were then established and appointed by the president. Each of them have a story, too. I have not found yet in my research that Governor John Henry Kincaid designed it by his own hand. I can say definitively that he certainly commissioned it, it seems, somewhere around 1884, and I have inquiries out to confirm in his own memoirs if, in fact, he designed that initial one himself, the seal of the district. I would note for the record that there were some renditions. It did change somewhere between 1884 and 1910 where we had, I think originally there was, there you see the trees, there was a marine vessel, there was clearly a kayak, some igloos, there was, I'm referring to the one on the right, there was not a placer miner with a pickaxe digging a hole. You can vaguely see the seals on the beach. But we did transition from 1884, we have Kincaid there on the top left, through these various governors. At this time we had a more stabilized tenure. These gentlemen were all, on average, four-year tenures, appointed by the U.S. president, also four-year terms. And here we see, at that point, 1909, 1910, the seal of the district was more clearly defined there, and you can tell the specific icons of the aurora, the mountains, the dense forest, either cargo or more likely military ships, missionary ship, the placer miner, igloos, iceberg, kayak, and the seals on the beach. It was with Walter Eli Clark, who was the last district governor and transitioned into the first territorial governor, that then, according to the records I found so far, made it clear that he wanted a seal that focused more on Alaska's industrial and resource potential, and that's where we saw doing away with of the dense forests, and now we have a mining smelter on a treeless hillside. The seals are gone, replaced by farming, which later on was identified as wheat. From 1913 to 1958, just before statehood, that territorial seal was then co-opted from the 1910 version, and to this date, from 1959, when we became a state, first Governor Egan entered the picture, the territorial seal was essentially adopted into our state seal, and that's what we have to this day. I've got here the side-by-side from essentially what was the state seal, black and white. The center one is colorized, and the one on the right, top right, is what you most commonly see, I suppose, on letterhead and around the state, which I refer to as our gilded seal. And I would offer that, in my opinion, the gilded seal, you lose those details as to what is even being portrayed on that seal. So this is a side-by-side. This is where we started, approximately 1884. And this is where we are presently in 2006. So I just wanted to offer kind of a how did we get here. I would conclude with some thoughts that, you know, a lot of the rhetoric we're going to hear is that we have too many other more important things that were facing us. This proposal would delegate the project to the artistic, historical, philanthropic, cultural institutions in our state to take this on and come back to us with what ideally would be a more modernized seal. And perhaps it could be argued that this is an opportunity and even a blessing to rebrand Alaska. That concludes my presentation, Madam Chair. I'm happy to take any questions, or I could go into – I didn't render a formalized sectional, but I did – I do have an outline I can go through to sort of offer the structure, timeline, budget, and so forth for the project.
Are there any questions from committee members? How about you go through a brief analysis of what is included in the concurrent resolution?
Okay, so again, for the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. As is fairly plainly written in the resolution itself, the purpose is to evaluate the current official seal of our state, to recommend changes to that seal to better represent its people, to prepare draft legislation necessary to carry out its recommendations, to recommend an educational program regarding the history and meaning of our state seal. The membership is proposed to be at 14 members, three from the House of Representatives. That would include one member of the Minority Caucus, three members from the Senate. That would include one member of the Senate Minority Caucus. And I would mention that this is fairly boilerplate common structure that we've been using for quite some time. Third would be the Lieutenant Governor or his or her designee. Since the Lieutenant Governor by statute is the keeper of our seal, a member representing the Alaska State Council on the Arts, the Alaska Humanities Forum, the Alaska Historical Society, University of Alaska, the Rasmussen Foundation, the First Alaskans Institute, and a high school student leader. Leadership of the task force commission, rather, would be someone that the Senate President and the Speaker jointly appoint from among the legislative members of the Commission. The administration of the Commission would include and encourage, to the extent practical, meetings and votes telephonically or via teleconference. The expected initial organizational meeting and at least the, say, the final report hearing are the only two that we would expect to be in person, but wouldn't be limited to that. The commission can request data and other information from state and legislative agencies. The staff of the chair of the commission would provide staffing support for the commission. Its budget was specifically crafted to invite and encourage, seek and accept the use of grants, gifts of money, professional or consulting services from other public and private sources, and, of course, to the extent practical, a legislative appropriation. The timeline is to have its recommendations and findings due by May 14th of 2027, essentially toward the end of session. The commission would then expire at that time unless they vote by two-thirds of its memberships to extend its work, in which up to essentially 6 weeks, the end of June, to expire. That concludes the overall summary structure and timeline of the commission, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions? Mr. Lampkin, I do have one question. As I just noticed that the student leader is just student good standing. Is it the intent to have a student leader from the Alaska Association of Student Governments or just simply any student who says, I'm interested?
Madam Chair, so the intent was to not be too prescriptive with that language. That's, again, common language that we've been using to set up other task forces for quite some time. Senator Stevens has been very much supportive of including our young leaders in these processes. So we would certainly look to the Association of Student Governments, but wouldn't want to limit our recruitment that way.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we can move on to your invited testifiers. We do have with us here in the room Ben Brown, who is the chair of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Mr. Brown. if you'd like to identify yourself for the record and then begin your comments when you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good to be here today and to see you all. I am Ben Brown, and I am the chairman of the Alaska State Council on the Arts, which is Alaska's state arts agency. I was first appointed to the Board of Trustees by Governor Murkowski, and then Governor Palin appointed me chairman in 2007, and I've been subsequently reappointed by every governor since, including for a third time last year by the Honorable Mike Dunleavy. So I've seen the State Council on the Arts involved in processes somewhat akin to this. The one that when I got a call from Mr. Lampkin on behalf of Senator Stevens, Madam Chair, to ask me to say a few words today was the design for the quarter when they were doing state quarters. And one thing that immediately jumped out at me when I read Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 11 is how much more accelerated this timeline is. I think it's an ambitious timeline, but I think that's good. I think too much time for these creative processes can actually be detrimental. So I actually think it's good to set some strict deadlines and then have to adhere to them. And then even the extension provision in the concurrent resolution is for only a very brief period of time. But that's getting kind of into the particulars of it. From a larger perspective, the State Council on the Arts exists to promote the enjoyment and benefits of the arts in Alaskans' everyday lives. And things like state seals are symbols of who we are as a people and a place, and they matter. And the arts can really help people express themselves individually and collectively. And this would be a great opportunity for some collective expression by Alaskans to look at where we've come from. And I think the presentation, which I didn't see all of because I went to the location of the old Belts Room over in the Capitol before this was still a Masonic temple when I first came to work for this body of government. Anyhow, then I remembered, of course, it moved over here over a decade ago. But at any rate, as I was coming over here and then walked in, looking through the history of those state seals, it really is a very interesting history, just like we have a very interesting history as a state. But as I think is clear, that history has not been told from everyone's perspective. It's been told by a limited number of perspectives, and that's great to a certain extent. But I think we want to evolve with the passage of time and make sure that all Alaskans are participating and how we understand where we came from, where we are, and where we're going. So the State Council on the Arts, we haven't formally discussed it. We only meet quarterly, so I'm here in my capacity as chair. But I'm quite confident that all of our current trustees will think that this is a worthwhile idea, and that as long as the commission is appointed with an eye towards representing a diverse array of Alaskans, even with the accelerated timeline, it can do good work and come back with some recommendations to what is already a great seal and make it better. Another thought that I had after Mr. Lampkin reached out to me was, well, what about other things? And I would have to say if this were a proposal to revisit the state flag, I would not be in support of it because I think we have an amazing state flag, the best in the country, easily. But our state seal is a lot more complicated. It doesn't have the simplicity of eight stars of gold on a field of blue. So I think that in and of itself invites it to be looked at and for there to be thoughtful deliberation and debate. And I think this commission obviously is going to be a public-facing commission. It's going to take its deliberations and what it's asking people to think about and allow Alaskans from across the state to participate. And so I think just from, again, without having a formal action taken by the Board of Trustees of Alaska State Arts Agency, I'm confident that we as the Alaska State Council on the Arts can be supportive of this effort generally and specifically of Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 11. I don't want to take up a lot more time. I know there's some other invited witnesses, so I'm happy to answer any questions about ASCA generally or about our relationship to the work on this bill specifically. But all in all, thank you, Senator Stevens, through the chair for sponsoring it and for giving me a chance to come and say a few words.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I just want to thank you again for being here with us in person. We will move on to the next invited testifier. We're joined by Cordelia Kelly from the Alaska Humanities Forum. Ms. Kelly, if you can hear us, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Tobin and members of the committee. My name is Cordelia Kelly. I'm inked up from the North Slope, a resident of Anchorage, and serve on the board of the Alaska Humanities Forum. I appreciate that this has been a conversation for some time, looking at past efforts such as HCR 5 in the 23rd legislature to create a task force on the design of the state seal back in 2003. The first state seal created for Alaska, which was in use for 25 years, you know, depicted some characteristics familiar to us in our current seal, but there was also the inclusion of a human element. Native people and non-native people were depicted living and harvesting from the land.
Under our first territorial governor, the seal that we are now familiar with was created in 1910, and Alaska Native people, once represented, were removed. So Alaska Native people actually lost representation in the transition to our current state seal. When I look at the state seal, I question its audience. You know, I see a lot of industry, but what about people living? Is the only human that we see, the only one that is visible on a plow and horses, the best representation of our history, present, and future? You know, we can also point to some of the finer details that are outdated. Mining is represented by an ore smelter, which does not exist in the state. The days of government contracts to commercial companies for seal hunting have long come and gone. But more so, it begs the question, who is our state seal for? You know, there's this article in 1911 for Alaska Yukon Magazine, which wrote that the very rays of sun represented, quote, the dawn of the commercial and industrial era in Alaska. Are we still a colony for America, or are we at home? My final point is that there was never a public process. We never had an open design contest like we did for our state flag. We didn't have 6,000 school children weigh in on our seal, then sign it into law like we did for our state bird. SCR 11 would give Alaskans that very first chance. Plano, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you again for testifying today. We'll now move on to for public testimony for SCR 11. Opening public testimony. Is there anyone here in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none and seeing no one online, I will now close public testimony. President Stevens, any wrap-up comments?
Well, just very briefly, I appreciate your hearing this. I enjoyed the historical elements of it. Actually, Tim said he'd like to take my Alaska history class. Actually, he could teach it, I think. It's a fascinating history that we have in developing this seal. But I would hope that it's time to think about it. Maybe it's time to have a more comprehensive seal. And we can see, as the lady mentioned earlier, that Native Alaska has been left out of our more modern seals.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. And I do relish the opportunity to see 6,000 young kids make renderings and drawings and to get to choose amongst them. At this time, I plan to hold SCR 11 till a future meeting. If there's any changes to the language that you would like to consider, if you could please work with the bill sponsor in my office, and we will bring it back before us at a later date. Now moving on to our final item on the agenda is the first bill hearing for Senate Bill 157 and its companion bill, which is House Bill 176. Senate Bill 157 is sponsored by Senator Rob Myers. He is here with his legislative intern, Aaron Raybuck, to present the bill. Senator Myers, you know the drill. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your opening remarks.
Thank you, Chair Tobin, and members of the Education Committee. For the record, Robert Myers, Senator for District Q. Joining me on my left today is my intern, Aaron Raybuck. Today we're going to be presenting SB 157, the Student Fee Transparency Act. Before Mr. Raybuck provides a section analysis, I just wanted to touch on the sponsor statement and why we introduced the bill last year. So the issue before us began with some students at the University of Alaska. In February of last year, the Associated Students of the University of Alaska passed a formal resolution expressing concern about the consolidated fee structure and urging the legislature to promote legislation ensuring fee transparency for all UA students. Their concern was pretty straightforward. Students can see and pay a consolidated fee that is broken into general categories, but they often cannot see how much of their money is going to each service or program. Student fees of the UA system were consolidated at the three main campuses beginning in 2020. So, for example, when I was in school about 20 years ago, I actually saw the breakdown of where each of the fees were going and how much they were. While the consolidated fee was convenient for administration, the transparency for the students was less than fee nominal. There is no statutory requirement that students be consulted when fees are created or increased. UAF has previously involved students in these types of discussions, but that structure was then modified once the consolidated fee was implemented, and that structure was then modified to exclude fee decisions, and there is no consistent process across the different campuses. So the problem we're trying to solve here is not the existence of fees themselves. The university is fully in charge of what fees get charged, and we have no interest in getting involved in that. The problem here is clarity and notice. When students receive a bill, they should be able to understand what they're paying for. SB 157 addresses that in two ways. First, it requires the Board of Regents to provide notice to students when a new fee is implemented or when an existing fee is increased, ensuring that students are not surprised by these changes affecting their cost of attendance. The second, the bill requires itemized billing statements showing how much students pay for each portion of the fee and where those funds are allocated. In other words, we're simply asking for the receipt. Students are instructed to show their work, and this bill asks the university to do the same. This does not change how much the university may charge, nor does it seek to micromanage budgeting decisions. It doesn't set the price tag. It just makes it a bit more readable. It seeks to build trust between students and the university and does not impose any fiscal impact. With that, Madam Chair, if you'd like, Mr. Raybuck can read the sectional analysis for SB 157 when he has completed it. At least in theory, Representative Carrick's office would be taking over, but I believe she's still on the floor at the moment, so we may have to modify that plan slightly.
Thank you. Mr. Raybuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And hello to members of the committee. My name is Aaron Raybuck, intern for Senator Myers, and I'll be reading the sectional. Section 1 creates a short title for this bill. Section 2 adds subsection AS 14.40.170, which requires the Board of Regents to specify three things before imposing a new fee. 1, the amount of the fee. 2, the reason for the fee. And 3, the fee's status as temporary or permanent. Section 3 adds a new section, AS 14.40.252, that requires the University of Alaska to provide students with itemized billing statements showing all tuition and fees that were charged to the student. Section 4 establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2027.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Raybuck. With that, are there any questions from committee members? Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Myers, thank you for bringing this bill forward. My question is, as we look at any regulation like this, what's to stop the university from changing their bill structure? If they want to account for costs, could they not just increase tuition and keep fees the same to avoid raising fees? It seems like I understand what you're attempting to do here. I think it's laudable. But I'm afraid it, we just wind up playing whack-a-mole and only create additional administrative burden for the university that takes time and increases cost. What's to stop the university from just increasing tuition to cover services that are paid for currently by fees?
Through the chair to Senator Bjorkman. So obviously there's nothing that we're going to do to try to stop the university from increasing tuition for whatever purpose they have. As I mentioned, when I was in school 20 years ago, they already did this effectively. Now the issue here that we're dealing with is we're not talking about fees in terms of course fees or something of that nature. We've been in discussions with the university, with Representative Carrick's office to clarify some of those matters, and we hope to bring forth a committee substitute to address some of those things. You know, we're not after, you know, the parking fee or something like that. The issue that we're facing with these consolidated fees is that those go to specific services or specific groups on the university campus. So, for example, at UAF, we would have a fee that would go to the Student Rec Center. We have a fee that goes to student government. Multiple fees like this, and what we're saying, one of the issues that we're running into here is now not only do the students not know what they're paying for, but those different groups don't necessarily know how much money they're getting either. And so if the university ups tuition and gives those groups more money, I'm sure that those groups would be happy, but they want to know how much of their money they're getting, and so that the university doesn't necessarily they're not able to necessarily change that from year to year. Oh, well, you know, we've decided this year that, well, the consolidated fee isn't going up because we don't want to charge students more money because they're going to complain about the dollar figure. But we're going to just kind of behind the scenes change some of the distribution. So that's what we're trying to address here is more transparency on where those dollar figures are coming from, where those dollar figures are going, how they're being spread out among the various groups that are funded by the consolidated fee.
And Senator Meyer, just so you know, Representative Carrick has joined us. Oh. So if you'd like to pass the baton, you are welcome to do so at any point in time. But I know Senator Bjorkman has a follow-up.
I'm happy to take the follow-up while I'm here, swapping out, I'm happy to do that as well.
Very good. Yeah, just curious. So what fees on a bill that a student will receive are a student government organization responsible for? And I'll ask that in a different way, and you can respond however you want. I'm not familiar with the UA system. Is there a student government that levies a tax on students to provide for student government activities that might include a newspaper or other things that the student government does, and is that accounted for separately?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, the student government fee is a portion of the consolidated fee. And so that is created in conjunction with the university administration as to how much they're going to be allowed to get. Again, the point of the bill here is not to short-circuit any of those negotiations or anything. It's really going to help empower the student government, because once that dollar figure is published, now they know what they're getting on a per student basis as they're coming through, so that the university can't turn around later and say, well, we've changed our minds and you know, the consolidated fee hasn't changed, but how much of that money is now going to the student government has changed.
Senator Bjorkman?
Understood. Just to clarify this, do student governments across the UA system have the ability to levy a tax on students to provide for student activities, and is that tax then shown on a tuition bill?
Oh, I think I understand your question better. Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, they cannot levy that on their own. They have to do that through the administration. The administration is the one that sets that fee. Then they can make requests, and they occasionally do make requests to up the fee structure every now and then. But they cannot pick that on their own.
Understood.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator Meyer. If you'd like to change out, we can do that and have Senator Carrick. I do want to note, just because I was on the UAA concert board, and for any fee that we wanted to increase, we actually had to go to a vote of the student body. So there's a bit of a different process for some of the fees that are applied to students. Representative Carrick, if you'd like to come join us here at the dais, I think we are in the question and discussion phase. I know Senator Keel has a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm getting just a little bit into the mechanics of the bill. I take it from the context of the Senate sponsor's comments that when a bill lines out the facility fee and the infrastructure fee and the parking fee and the bookstore fee and the consolidated fee, that doesn't count as itemized. Itemized is intended as reading between the lines here to split out what is currently consolidated?
Through the chair, actually for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks. Through the chair to Senator Keel. Sorry, we've been on the floor all day today. Yes, so the consolidated fee is the portion that's targeted through the current legislation. The fees that are currently split out that are not part of the consolidated fee would remain as they are currently. The components of the consolidated fee are what would be further specified, with the additions that our office is requesting this committee to consider, I would note, because currently in the legislation, the course fees would potentially be needed to be listed out, and it's not our intention that that take place. So there is a little bit of nuance to change in order to achieve that effect, but that is the hope of the sponsors.
Senator Keel?
Thank you. The other just textual question, is it Section 2 of the bill could be read to require every UA student get notice of every fee, and I assume that that's not the intent if we create a brand new fee at UAS to cover the Ketchikan Marine Tech Center. You don't need that in Fairbanks?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that is correct. That is our intent, is to specifically target those fees which are system-wide and or campus-wide. And the university does have, and the administrators can speak better to this and how they manage their student list populations, but they have the ability to, say, target all UAS-enrolled students versus all UAF-enrolled students. The intention here would be that if you're a UAF-enrolled student, for example, and you're paying a fee which applies to all UAF students, but which may not apply at the other campuses, that you would have notification of what that fee is under that, what is now currently consolidated fee.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Seeing none, let's see here. Now I've lost my script. I do note that you have several other issues that you would like to bring up as you've been talking with the university and you've proposed or have recommended some additional changes. And so as we work with this legislation, please work with the bill sponsor and also with my office for additional concerns. I, too, share some of the concerns around fees for resident life, fees for the health centers, or fees associated with particular bodies. It also would be helpful if we could get a printout of the existing landing page that students do see so we can have an idea of what currently is itemized and then what may be considered that that consolidated fee. As a student myself, I often see it and I do wonder what is in it. But I also recognize that much of our university depends on us participating in many different ways financially. Any additional questions before we move on to analysis of the fiscal note and then into public testimony? I do not see any invited testifiers at this time, but we do have someone online for public testimony. Seeing none, we do have a fiscal note associated, and we are joined by the Government Relations Manager for the University of Alaska here, Katie McCall. Ms. McCall, if you could please identify yourself for the record and walk us through the fiscal note.
Good afternoon, Senator Tobin, members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Katie McCall, Government Relations Manager for the University of Alaska system. So before you today, you have the fiscal note for House Bill 176. That is OMB component number 1296. The control code there at the bottom is MHOTJ. This is a zero fiscal note. You can see the analysis on the back. This legislation amends AS14.40.170, add requirements for the Board of Regents' communications to students regarding new or increased student fees and itemized billing statements. We do not anticipate a fiscal impact from this legislation. We are in line with the intent of the sponsors of this shared goal of transparency for students. Much of our existing board policy, shares that intent, and we don't see a fiscal impact for implementing this, and we're happy to continue working with the committee and the bill sponsors on a product that's workable for everyone.
And Ms. McCall, with some of the conversation here around being able to target or hyper-localize communications, is there any concern from the university that that may require additional technological programming that they don't already have access to?
Senator Tobin, thank you for the question. No, in our discussions, there hasn't been a concern. If we can modify the bill language a little bit to ensure we're not capturing students that aren't impacted by fee changes, that would be ideal because based on the discussion, obviously, we don't need to be notifying UAF students about a change that only impacts UAS students. And that is, we can absolutely capture that, won't have a fiscal impact.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. McCall. Any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll now move on to public testimony. I'll now open public testimony for Senate Bill 157 and its companion bill, House Bill 176. Is there anyone here in the room who wishes to testify? Ms. Hall, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Miriam Hall. I am speaking today in my own capacity as a student currently enrolled at UAA. You know, I want to express support for Senate Bill 157 and its companion, HB 176. I'm a non-traditional student, and I am currently self-funding my education. So I pay attention to the numerous fees that I pay for, and I know they've already kind of covered what you know this bill is intended to cover. And the consolidated fee, I will say from my own experience, that was something that I made an effort to figure out what was in it. It was not easy to find out what was in it, and I still don't know the dollar breakdown of what is in it. There are a number of services that, you know, are important that the consolidated fee covers. I participate in some of them. I'm a member of student government. And there are some things that maybe I don't benefit from. And I believe that if more students knew what they were paying for, it would increase the threshold of accountability for students to exercise their right to join student government, to testify, to make their voices heard of what they want to be paying for in a fee and what they don't. And so I am in support of the intent of this bill. I'm not an expert on, you know, how to make it work in the best way possible, but I am strongly in support of the intent. I'll also say I do work full time. Like I said, I'm a non-traditional student, so I take classes across the university system. And I personally, again, I'm one student, but I would like to know when, you know, if I'm enrolled in a Kenai, you know, Peninsula College class, I would like to know if my consolidated fee through the Kenai campuses is increased or the UAS campus is increasing. So in any given semester, I may be enrolled at multiple campuses, depending on what classes are available. And so, you know, yes, if I'm not necessarily enrolled at UAF, maybe I don't need that, but some semesters I may be. Those fees do change all the time. And unless you're paying attention closely to what's happening, at this point, you don't necessarily know. So, like I said, I'm in support and just wanted to give one student's perspective. So,
thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hall. Is there no other folks here in the room who wishes to testify? I will now go online, and seeing no one online, I'll now close public testimony. Any additional questions from committee members? Any wrap-up comments?
For the record, Representative Carrick again. I just wanted to thank the chair and the members of the committee for looking at both the companion bill and now the House Bill 176, the vehicle for this legislation. I also wanted to say that I do echo the comments of Ms. McCall that the university is similarly very interested in and focused on transparency and accountability. It's my belief that this legislation is additive to the efforts that have taken place over time. And I think sometimes what we find is things don't change in a permanent way to a positive effect for even the public testifier we heard today to some of those student desires without statutory change. This is one of those areas that over time has presented a challenge at various points, but I do think the university is really focused on this issue as well. I'm very happy to collaborate with them and just want to thank the committee for also working with our office.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Carrick. At this time, I'm going to hold House Bill 176 and its companion, Senate Bill 157, till a future meeting. If you could please work with the bill sponsor in my office on any amendments that you would like to consider. This concludes our agenda for today. As there is no other business before the committee today, I will also want folks to note that we will not be meeting this Friday. Our next meeting will be on Monday, March 2nd, right here in the Belts Committee Room. Same bat time, same bat place. With that, I will adjourn today's meeting at 4:44 p.m.